Thank you so much for being here on a morning when you have lost an hour and when it's so early. So we super appreciate it. But also we hope that we give you that hour back by having a really great conversation. We have an awesome panel here. So welcome to Socializing the Presidency, Digital Politics 2012. I am Christina Bellantoni. I'm the political editor at PBS NewsHour. And one of the reasons I'm moderating this panel is because I strongly believe in social media, and I think that it's a really important tool, not just for journalism, but also for politics. So I think we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that today. And without further ado, just a little bit about my background. I've only been at the NewsHour for about 2 months, my first job in television, because I'd always been in newspapers. And I have always strongly believed in social media, and particularly Twitter. And just a little fun fact, at every organization I've ever worked, I've been the first person to ever request putting my Twitter handle on my business card. So that's it's surprising that that's still an innovative thing, and now a lot of people are doing it. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our panel, and I'll just go left to right, not in order of importance, of course. Maria Teresa Kumar is the founding executive director of Voto Latino, and she has been working with Latino youth and engaging them in politics for many years. She was named one of the 20 most notable Latinos under 40 by Poder magazine. You see her frequently on MSNBC, and she has made a lot of contributions to this field. Craig Newmark is the customer service rep for Craigslist, he likes us to say. He doesn't remember me, but I actually wrote a story about him in September 2001, back when Craigslist was just a little glimmer, hoping to put newspapers out of business by ending classified ads. Just kidding. And one thing that's notable about Craig is we're all sort of inside the Beltway people living in Washington, D.C., except Craig, who lives out in California and really gives us that unique outsider perspective, which is so important when it comes to social media and politics and this presidential race. Heather Smith is the president of Rock the Vote, which has been for two decades working to get young people involved in politics and registered to vote. In 2008, they broke all records, registering 2.2 million new voters, which is something that she's going to talk quite a bit about, particularly the new tools to reach those voters and engage people. And Mary Catherine Hamm is a frequent television contributor. You've probably seen her most recently on The O'Reilly Factor. But one of the reasons that she's on this panel is because she is truly a multi-platform journalist, someone who can be on television, write stories frequently on Twitter, do radio. You know it all, and you can do it all. And that's really what's happening to particularly political journalism and this campaign. So the scenario that I wanted to start out with to introduce this topic goes a little something like this. You're a woman who donated to John Kerry in 2004, gave him $200 because you wanted him to defeat George W. Bush. But you're not really that interested in politics, and perhaps your Facebook page is more about cupcake recipes you see on Pinterest than politics. But you clicked like on an article about Susan G. Komen and it stopping its funding of Planned Parenthood recently. And you started a conversation with some of your friends on Facebook about that. Now, the political campaigns know who you are. They can start targeting you with ads on Facebook, and they can start deciding whether they're going to send you a fundraising email from Ann Romney or Joe Biden, or if they decide to pull out Michelle Obama. They might just ask you for your money, or they might remind you to vote. And I made that scenario up, but based on all the different people I've talked to, this is a completely plausible thing with the tools we have for social media and politics today. And I think it's just sort of an interesting opening discussion topic for the panel of, you know, in each of your fields, what are you seeing in social media? How are these trends changing? And what is the difference between 4 years ago? And I'll start with Maria Teresa.
I think that 2008 was very much about how social networking changed political fundraising. And that was the 2008 narrative. I think the 2012 narrative is how social media is going to change communications. And one of the best examples is everybody's very concerned right now with Citizens United. And they're concerned with Citizens United because it's manipulating the way not only our candidates are presenting, but there's also at the fundamental, the reason that super PACs exist is to go negative on your candidate. Right now, it's been very much a closed election with the usual suspect of older voters who are getting their, who consume the majority of their media, mostly from television. They have yet to unleash the social media mavens who will take that, who will take, go ahead and take that ad, go into their social network and actually deconstruct it for truthiness, so to speak. And the less truthiness, the more the candidates are going to get in trouble. And what I'm seeing right now, especially with social media, is also is with Voto Latinos, increasingly an opportunity for folks that are on the ground to start sharing stories that are happening at the local level that we're being able to break through into the national narrative that you wouldn't see before. As just a brief example, there was a 14-year-old young woman who was deported, who African-American from Texas, from Houston, who was deported because she gave a false name. She was reported to Columbia. We received the script. We received a lead on through Voto Latino, and then we were able to basically put it not only on our social networks, but also work with different media partners. And the next we know that it actually not only opens up the possibility for a narrative, but then they actually track her down in Columbia and actually are able to bring her home. But that wouldn't have happened if we didn't have sophisticated networks at the local level working with national organizations.
For me, the big difference is that we now, as individuals, can make a difference ourselves. The deal is that we don't have to rely on those fancy Washington facts and things like that, but we could actually do things ourselves, and that makes a difference. For example, days ago, I just attended a conference in Boston called Truthiness in Digital Media, the focus of which is dealing, how do you provide a remedy? I mean, in an attempt at cleverness, I've said that the press should be the immune system of democracy, but it's also up to us as individuals to play a role. And one of the people I spoke to there, Kathleen Jamieson, is the director of the group which does factcheck.org, which is at this point venerable. They recently announced flackcheck.org. The idea is that if they find a super PAC ad which is provably deceptive, not gray area, not spin, but just out and out deceptive, you can do things like if your local TV station is running those ads, you can let them know that, hey, these ads are deceptive. You need to yank them from the air because, you know, running deceptive ads does not serve the political interest, and you can go ahead and actually do something. You get to make a difference because, you know, folks, I need you to do what you can to make a difference, and social media allows us for the first time ever to really do that.
Great. Hi, everyone. Good morning. Good early morning. So compared to 4 years ago, you know, we used to look at what's the new technology, what is everybody using, or what could break through and actually help us bring our work into the digital space. And initially, that was because, you know, we were running voter registration drives, right? And you scale those by recruiting more volunteers and going to more places and talking to more people. And as things like Facebook and Twitter and all that and the internet in general allowed us to reach more people where they were at, using social media allowed us to scale our registration programs. So just even for comparison, over the last 20 years, our first campaign in 1992, we registered 200,000 voters. And that's with MTV and 1-800 numbers and, you know, volunteers on the ground. And that was massive at the time. Fast forward to 2008, and using all of those same vehicles, but also the internet, and in particular Facebook and MySpace at the time, to push voter registration out, we were able to reach and complete 2.2 million applications. So the scale that it provides us was immense. And the way we think about it is to just go where people are and put it in front of them and make it accessible, make it simple. What we're looking at this year compared to 4 years ago is not what's the new thing, but how do we apply some of the peer-to-peer organizing that we've done in the past and that works on the ground to the existing tools that we've been using where people are online. And to me, that's what's really exciting about what we're doing this cycle. It's not just putting a request to register on Facebook anymore, but creating in-stream apps and tab applications in various different ways where people can not only register but share with their friends. Contesting that allows people online to run peer-to-peer registration campaigns that are then unlocking content and creating some gamification of that and rewarding them when they register more and more of their friends. In addition, it's making all that mobile-enabled, so as more people spend more time on their phones, it's taking the tools that they're already using and bringing them to them on their mobile phone. So being able to put it in front of them. I'm a walking billboard usually, but this is our QR code, so integrating it into merchandise, for example. So on the hang tags on our T-shirt, you'll see a QR code that then brings you to the voter registration application and other content. So really thinking about how to use existing technologies and platforms where people are already spending their time and allowing them to both register to vote at that place but also start facilitating peer-to-peer registration communications.
Hey, everybody. First of all, my Facebook serves me only ads for credit cards, shoes, and drug rehab centers. So I have no idea what it thinks I'm going to do, but whatever it is, it's disturbing.
I'm going to hang out with you too. Yeah.
My search history is somehow not predictive of my actual job or personality, but maybe that's my dark, dark secret. So they might not target me correctly. But the interesting thing about the social media space and the ability for candidates and campaigns to target is that it is sort of the logical heir and the spiritual heir to the micro-targeting of the past, which and Republicans don't get a lot of credit for sort of being tech-savvy or employing a lot of this stuff, but the truth is actually in the Bush 2004 campaign, mostly headed up by Ken Melman, who was at the RNC at the time, that micro-targeting of people that they did actually through magazine subscriptions and what cars people drive and that kind of information that they were able to find on actual physical lists sort of has become so much more accessible to everyone, and it's so much more out in the open. It was a big change at the time, and now it's just sort of everywhere. Everything about you is quantified in a way that it just was not before. I think a shift you're seeing from 2008 to now is, and since I do the political side, you do see a little bit of catching up among Republicans, technologically speaking. 2010 was actually a really interesting year where the grassroots actually led on this. There are a lot of studies that show that conservatives and Republicans sort of counterintuitively were way far ahead of Democrats on Twitter and using Twitter as an organizing tool. And I think that comes, as it did when Democrats were ahead, from necessity. When you're in the wilderness, you have to organize better to get where you want to go. And so 2010, I think, was an indicator of that. The interesting thing that I've noticed is that in 2010, it sort of led from the bottom and floated up to the campaigns. I actually see a lot of more savvy among the grassroots that is not being adopted by campaigns. I think on the left and Democrats are far better at learning from their own grassroots and adopting those practices, and I think you see a lot of that in the Obama campaign. And they're able to then have a feedback loop and everybody gets better at their job. I think that's something that the right is not as good at. I think another thing that I've noticed is that it changes our relationship as consumers of the campaign media with reporters and with media. If you're a super activist and you're really, really paying attention to the campaign and the campaign trail, you know exactly who you're reading. You can follow them on Twitter. You probably know what they had for dinner Thursday night, whether you want to or not. And that really changes how you read media. For instance, like Christina and I think have had, four or five different jobs since the last time we went through a presidential election. But I follow Christina on Twitter because I know and trust Christina. It's not because she works for PBS. It was not because she worked for Roll Call. It's because I know and trust her, and I know I'm getting good information from her. A lot of people are making decisions that way, which is a new paradigm in media. It used to be if you have the Washington Post behind your name, everybody goes, okay, he's all right. A good example of this is Ben Smith from Politico, who a lot of people trusted Ben Smith. He goes over to BuzzFeed and everybody goes, what the heck are you doing? You're going to do video mashups now? Is that your new job? But people followed Ben because they trust Ben to be a dogged and good political reporter. So I think that's a shift you're seeing, and it allows for some of that fact-checking that Craig talks about, not only with ads, but also with reporters, and reporters are very aware of it. So you get that kind of feedback as well. So I think that's a shift.
And Ben has merged animal photos and politics very well. Yes. I completely applaud him on that effort. We're very grateful. So I'll turn this, Craig, I thought it was really great that you met somebody yesterday, I think it was, who told you they met their husband because of you from missed connections back in the early days of Craigslist. And so I want to ask this question of community. Is social media making politics more fun? Are people engaging in ways that they never did before because they're able to speak to one another wherever they are in the world?
It's hard for me to tell since I don't do fun. I'm a nerd plastic pocket protector at all. And yeah, I was born this way. Now, I do have the impression that people overall, we do want to work together to make things better for each other. You know, now and then we are our brother's or sister's keeper, and people are doing that in greater and more passionate ways. That's pretty good, and I like to see that. My interest, by the way, is in governance, not so much politics. And if anyone cares, I'm a libertarian moderate or libertarian pragmatist, which should confuse you, I hope. But that's actually kind of the sweet spot in my industry and geographic area. The mythology aside, San Francisco is more about that libertarian attitude than what people sometimes call right or left. But the deal is people are having the kind of fun, I guess, in this area, which involves a passion for something, of being able to make a difference. I guess if you watched the TV show The West Wing and thought that was exciting, then it's fun. Beyond that, if you do think it's fun, you do need to get out more.
So, and Maria Teresa, do you think, is this a conversation when it's social media, is it isolating demographics, so it's, you know, people who are sort of similar in where they live and their status in society talking to one another, or is it really integrating? What are you seeing?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. There's a professor out of MIT that basically is looking at, you know, when the individuals that were actually on MySpace versus Facebook, and you saw a digital divide there, not necessarily with access, but also the folks that who was talking to whom. And MySpace for a long time was mostly the population I was targeting, mostly densely urban young Latinos. And Facebook was more elitist. It was more college educated individuals that were and just because of where it was started, right? One was started deeply in the music industry, and another one was started very much on a college campus. We've seen an evolution of that, though, where folks from MySpace have migrated into Facebook, and you do see a greater interaction of I would say, socioeconomic class and race. But the beauty about Facebook is also the folks that would historically not really be paying attention to, let's take the example of the Dream Act kids, folks that would not be paying attention to the Dream Act kids, basically undocumented youth that are trying to get a pathway to citizenship, all of a sudden are having a huge swell of support from progressives in a way that you haven't seen historically. And you're seeing it translate not just online, but offline. So most recently there was a group of African-American Baptists, preachers, in Georgia that basically, I'm sorry, North Carolina, that did a march on behalf of undocumented and undocumented dreamers. And they were able to organize it essentially online first. That conversation would not have happened had they not had a place to actually assemble, disseminate, and learn their stories from each other. That sense of community was first start online and then translated to actionable items offline.
Very interesting. Mary Catherine, I'm curious, when we think about social media and particularly this presidential campaign, a lot of people will say, well, Ron Paul has this huge movement behind him. And I'm wondering if you think that social media is an accurate depiction of the real energy behind a campaign, or does it give some people an outsized sense of importance because they're better organized?
Well, yeah, it depends. I think if you actually look at 2010, there are several studies about this that show that the amount of engagement online for, especially for House candidates, on Twitter, Facebook, just like the number of users was extremely predictive of who would win. The Scott Brown, Martha Coakley campaign in Massachusetts in 2009, a WordStream study caught this trend where Scott Brown was sort of surging before any of the political press because they were tracking his engagement online, and they found in the end a 10-to-1 difference in YouTube users, a 3-to-1 difference in Twitter, and a 4-to-1 difference on Facebook. And that kind of gap can make a huge difference. The question, I think, moving forward, I'm not sure. I think this may be the last election where that will be predictive, because it's just going to become part of everyone's strategy. And in the presidential campaign, I'm not sure the actual numbers will be predictive. The way they use the media will be predictive. Romney, for instance, has a ton of Facebook followers or Facebook fans, but he does almost nothing with them. There's no attempt to actually engage. And so that's, sure, he's got a lot of people there, so the metrics look fine, but there's not that attempt, or at least in large part not yet, and I'm sure they'll get better about it as they go. The president, of course, his team very good at jumping into the conversation, giving a little back and forth, but I would also caution, I hate to throw rain on everybody's parade because there's been enough rain already here, but there is an interesting thing in this election where you see campaigns are just brand campaigns. They want to protect their brand. They want to get elected. And no matter who it is, and some of them really keenly want to engage with people, and that's part of the mission, but they want to engage with people with an end, which is to get elected. So part of their job is to protect their message and to keep it disciplined. And so, as with every new technology, a brand or a candidate or a campaign will appropriate that and learn to use it for their message, right? Not necessarily for open engagement with you. And I think you see that sometimes in, for instance, the president does these question sessions and petitions and says, we're going to address these petitions. And does everybody know what the number one question or petition always is
every
in
time.
A presidential YouTube or town hall or Google Hangout?
Marijuana.
It's weed. Yeah. It's always weed. Weed is always number one. And the White House does not want to deal with that question. And so you get a lot of sort of dancing around it, and let's take these other questions, and it maybe doesn't reflect the actual engagement. So there are many ways that you can look at sort of punch holes in the type of engagement a campaign is having, and it's all in their best interest to sort of put their best foot forward and talk about the issues they want to talk about. But there is an element of, as they mature, as campaigns mature and learn how to sort of get a handle on these, it will become less about real engagement. And that's something that's sort of our duty as consumers to poke holes in that.
Okay. I'll violently agree regarding the use of social media and loss of control of message. One of the most successful practitioners of social media was a guy named Martin Luther. And the problem with social media from that point of view is that once you put a message out there, whoever you're intending to spread the message, virally or whatever, gets to send their own version of the message. Bottom line, that's why we have a whole bunch of different kinds of Protestant churches. So the deal is that social media can be effective. That's a good example of it. But you lose control right away, which is a good thing. The hidden agenda of that message is that social media is not new.
Heather, what sort of barriers are you seeing to voter participation, and are there technologies that can combat that or help, you know, Rock the Vote in particular sort of look at ways to fix it?
Yeah, I think there's two things that are barriers right now. Well, there's many, but there's two that are occupying a lot of our time trying to figure out. You know, on the one hand, there's a process barrier, right? Young people new to this process, not often being taught about how government, in particular politics, works, filling out a piece of paper and turning it in 28 days ahead of time. It feels very archaic, actually. And there's a lot of, you know, and you're not born knowing these things. And as we cut civic education funding and as we, you know, people don't tune into politics until it's way too late in many cases to actually register because they get targeted at the last minute. You end up with a process barrier where people just don't get registered and engaged. Right now, there's about 45 million 18 to 29-year-olds who are eligible to vote. That's one in four voters in our electorate today, and they're growing. There'll be about one in three voters by the 2016 election, the millennial generation. And yet only 40% of them are registered to vote. Once registered, they're voting at the same rates as everybody else. And I promise when we ask them, they say yes, and they're looking for that way to register. It's just getting it in front of them. So there's that process barrier. The second, though, I believe is a motivation barrier. It used to be, you know, we do a lot of work to make voting cool, right? We market voting, essentially. And want to make it part of your identity. As a young person in America, I am a voter. And that's something that you are proud of and want to, you know, kind of, it's punk rock, man. It's like the thing you want to be. And right now, politics is a dirty word. And even as we're talking about the social media, Mary Catherine, I couldn't agree more. It's like when it starts to feel fake, when it starts to feel irrelevant, it stops to feeling like it's really about you. And so I don't think this will be a year of candidate campaigns and voting for the sake of voting, but it's going to take a lot of motivation and a greater sense that I believe social media can play a role in, of feeling like there is this people over money, voters over money, and can we aggregate this sense of political power as voters to take back our democracy and take back our system? Can we fuel that and help people to understand that while they think the system might be broken, the way to fix it is to opt in, and the way that we do that is collectively? And so I was actually quite inspired by a lot of the organizing around, say, SOPA, where people actually did something collectively and felt like they could make control, they could make decisions and have real power. So those are the two barriers. I do believe that the social media can help impact both. On the process side, that we can share information and spread messages about registering. I also think there's some incredible advances we can use using new technology to modernize our election system. Dean Logan, who runs the largest elections process in the entire United States, who runs elections in LA County, is here and is doing some really innovative things to take, say, our social media or our social election tool to fill out a voter registration form and help directly sync it with the state's form so that someone can complete that process online. Also printing barcodes so when you scan it, that data can come back into the system and it's not being rekeyed. We reduce errors. So there's a lot that social media can do to reduce those barriers. And then second, I think convince people that people collectively do have power to take back our democracy.
Can I add one thing? I think the political landscape of 2008 and 2012 is very different. Yeah. And one of the things that we're not talking about is these voter ID laws that are all of a sudden sweeping across the country that intellectually make sense. But just to give you two examples, one is that there were 18 million voters who lost their homes in 2008 that now basically in certain states have to find and get re-registered and most likely get an ID. Not surprisingly, these voter ID laws, 11 of these 11 states control 2/3 of the electoral votes. They're in Texas, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, battleground states. And these battleground states, unfortunately, in Texas as an example, you could be a university student at the University of Texas, but that's not enough to show for you to go to the polls and cast a ballot. But if you have a concealed weapons ID, that's enough. So there's a clear disenfranchisement that's happening. And if you were to ask me what's the number one thing that social media can do, is to make sure that we start talking about it internally and externally, because unlike elections of the past, where you can get your information with centralized, whether it was PBS or CNN or ABC, NBC, that's not happening anymore. So part of what Southwest by Southwest, if you take anything out of this conference, is how do you start having these conversations of social ID? How do you actually make sure that you, not only are you registered, because you could be registered, but are you eligible just based on the fact that you have the proper ID? Because that's going to prevent millions of people from the polls. Unfortunately, it's going to be disproportionately young people who move frequently, African Americans, and Latinos.
Yeah, and if I could just add one more thing to that. We have an obligation, I think, to let people know that the rules of the game have changed. And, you know, in 33 states, there is legislation that's been proposed that will make it, in many ways, in particular for the constituencies Maria Teresa was talking about, harder to vote. In Wisconsin, Texas, your student IDs no longer count. In New Hampshire, they're changing the definition of residency if this law that's going in front of the state house or the state legislature this week actually passes. In Florida, there's restrictions that actually, Rock the Vote shut down our volunteer-led operations in the state as a result. We, are fighting back. But we need to share the information that the rules have changed. But we have to be careful how we do that, too. There's an obligation that comes with it. If we go out and say, it's impossible now to register and vote in these places, these people who are impacted by these laws, who already feel like, you know, it's confusing and they don't understand the process and it's kind of intimidating and do it for the first time, now hear that it's this much harder, we're going to start depressing turnout, not facilitating greater participation. So making sure we say, hey, yes, it is a lot harder, and it feels at times like students are intentionally being left out of this process or being targeted by these ID laws. But here's what we can do. One, make sure you know what the rules are and where to get that information. Share that. And then two, don't let them. If it really is about, you know, these two sources of power, people and money, let's call it voters and money, and you feel like there's a power grab happening, which is kind of the mindset right now of a lot of young people. And one of that is, you know, we fight that with greater participation. I recently heard somebody say, in this current environment, if you're afraid of the role that money will play in politics, well, don't worry. If we actually had full participation, people would kick money's ass, right? And when they're trying to take away that avenue to greater participation, it makes you feel like you're being personally attacked. And I think we can use that to incite people to demonstrate that fuller participation is what we're striving for, and that is how we will, in fact, take back our country.
Great.
I wanted to touch on when you mentioned the SOPA issue. As far as increasing motivation goes, social media spaces are good at recognizing stories that the old media does not, that are interesting to people, that they almost completely miss out on sometimes. And there's a Pew study from 2009 that shows, or it studied the blog space and the social media space in 2009 and found, so there's this August 3rd to 9th this week that was completely dominated in the regular media by healthcare town halls. It was almost the only story that you could hear anything about. Online, on blogs, it was a story about a woman suing her college for not helping her get a job. And on Twitter, this is my favorite one, the top story on Twitter that week was a story about an outage on Twitter itself. Which is sort of funny and navel-gazing. But the point being that you can actually pick up on stories that were not part of the fabric of our discussion, you know, even 4 years ago, mm-hmm. that are completely new, that affect constituencies that maybe are not paid attention to in the mainstream media. And that has a lot of power. You can drive from the bottom up. You can drive a narrative. You can drive these stories. They're often human interest stories that maybe don't have the political impact that that the media likes to cover. It's not Congress. It's not inside baseball. It's not electoral politics. But it's something that has an impact on people's lives, and I think those can bubble up in a way they could not before. And on Twitter, specifically, the study showed it's something like 40% of stories are technology-based. The people who are on Twitter are very interested in technology, and I think that's an interesting point for campaigns trying to reach out on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That's your news hook, because the people on Twitter are interested in tech news, and I think there's ways to engage them in that way.
I am particularly interested in this whole issue of people making sure that they have the ability to vote. And while the press is the immune system of democracy, I'm finding that I'm going to have to do my own fact-checking regarding this matter, learning myself, and I hope to become educated enough in the next 30 days. For example, I'm talking to the folks at AARP, you know, retired persons, since they say that they think that about 18% of senior citizens may not be able to vote just because they won't fulfill traditional requirements, just because they've moved, they've lost their records and stuff like that. And this is of concern to me as I enter my own sunset years. And so I'm looking out for my age cohort. But the deal is that there is something apparently real going on with this stuff, but I'm going to reserve judgment until I can learn more and then do something about it.
So without giving away any trade secrets, just a question for all four of you. Are any of your organizations or news outlets identifying sort of word trends out on Twitter, on Facebook, to try to understand what people are feeling, get a sense of sort of the mood of the country?
Well, I think it's hard to avoid the trend that's happening over the past couple days, which I do think says a lot about where young people are at, and that's just the whole Kony 2012 video. I mean, there's something, it certainly hit a nerve in America, but there's from that I take away a couple things. One, the use of film and storytelling is a really powerful, a very powerful method. But the filmmaker was actually at an event that I was at maybe 6 months ago, and he and I were talking about how to organize people using film, because it's something, video film, that Rock the Vote clearly has spent a lot of time thinking about. And he said, you need a foil, you need a bad guy, and then you need a happy ending, something that people can do to get involved. So it's interesting to then see how he put that into practice. But I also, I don't think it would have taken off had they not been organizing on the ground. I don't think there's a college campus I visited last year that didn't know about Invisible Children and the work they were doing. I first got involved in kind of following them and working with them, I think it was in 2009, when they were doing this thing called The Rescue, where they were standing outside of places in about 90 cities around the country and they would stand out there as abducted young people waiting to be rescued. And they were calling on people with large microphones to come out and rescue them. And every time they got rescued, that person was forced to talk about and address the issue of these abducted children and make them more visible. And the last one was in Chicago. And every time a team got rescued, they all kind of congregated in the next one, the next one, the next one. And there was thousands and thousands of young people ultimately ended up in Chicago outside of Oprah Winfrey's studio. And the first day they got ignored. The next day they were told to go away again. The next day Oprah brought them cupcakes, rearranged their show, and put them on television. They were rescued. But so it wasn't just a one-time thing that just happened this week. But in fact, thousands and thousands and thousands of young people on college campuses here and around the world have been being organized around this issue for a long time. So that base existed to help spread this, and I think that's important to remember. The organizing still matters. Obviously, technology helped facilitate the spread. But then the third thing that I am really enjoying is how they're using celebrity and those with large media microphones to actually promote and push a message in an effective way. And whether that was the 2009 rescue with Oprah finally putting them on TV their targets for Twitter right now. While a lot of people in politics might follow Christina or Mary Catherine or Ben Smith and trust them, young people who might not be paying attention to politics right now are getting a lot of are actually following pop culture icons who they look to for information. And so an effective way to use celebrity voice to get information out about an issue.
I would say the aftermath of the video and all of the aggressive fact-checking and occasionally aggressive bitching about it is the perfect example of what will, like, if you succeed, there are plenty of people out there who will come and start poking holes in your theory. And that's sort of, the electoral cycle is an amplified version of that every single day. There are always, and this was less adversarial. You're not really looking to poke holes in this because it's a good thing. It's on balance. It does good, and it brings attention to an issue that needs to be paid attention to. Politics is by nature adversarial, so anything you put out there, there's just a huge crowd, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, there to fact check your every move. And that's what I enjoy about it, because it does, it give us more dishonesty sometimes? Yes, but it does also give us more honesty, and I enjoy that. Yes,
absolutely.
And at least transparency. Yeah.
But I have to say, the controversy has certainly kept this going.
Right.
Well, and I think most recently, even what happened with Komen and Planned Parenthood, right? Yeah. They had decided that they were going to use traditional media and basically defund Planned Parenthood, and Feministing got a hold of it and blew it up. And one of the most respected brands all of a sudden fell to its knees in a matter of days. And I think that's where the power of social media, the power of, again, truthiness, the power of transparency really comes into play. And it holds people accountable. And it may take 3 or 4 days, but if it's that egregious, it actually happens. And that's where I think that's where the silver lining is in the 2012 election, is it's going to be really up to folks in this room and your networks to ensure that people don't get away with it.
And both of those examples that you both brought up are examples of people that weren't necessarily involved in politics,
exactly,
suddenly social media engaging them in a new way, whether that's far younger people that are even eligible to vote, or, you know, a lot of women that weren't necessarily interested in politics to begin with. So quick housekeeping, we're going to start taking your questions. I think we're in a small enough room we can all hear each other, but if there is an extra microphone, if we need to pass it around, you can use the social prez hashtag if you want to ask your question on Twitter instead of shout it to us. And I'll just ask one more quick question of, when you look at Twitter, do you think there are actually influenceable voters out there? So if you're a candidate and you're buying a sponsored tweet to reach people, or is it just people that believe what they believe and they're talking to each other?
I think people are open to information. I'll give you just a quick example. In 2008, we partnered with the census, and try to make the census sexy, right? Especially to 15, 17, 18-year-olds. And we identified celebrity and basically made them compete against each other, basically saying, you know, how fast can you make our hashtag be counted trend? Demi Lovato took it. She's a Disney hit kid. She took it, and within 20 minutes, it trended worldwide. But then it translated to our volunteer base growing, and it volunteered to actually individuals going in. My favorite story is a young woman in Central Valley who found us on Twitter based on Demi Lovato, had not heard of Voto Latino. I don't think she had even identified up to that point as being Latino. Loved the information she found. She took it and went to her church and got 200 people in her church to pledge the census. Right? So it's an opportunity to amplify not only your voice, but also see real on the ground results.
I'm disappointed to find, after participating and getting a study done, Twitter and some other forms of social media are not as effective as we had hoped. Facebook, maybe more so. What does matter is consistent, bottom-up, grassroots pressure from just regular people pushing upwards. The celebrity stuff is good for occasional attention, but, you know, photo ops... Well, sometimes you get to meet fancy people, but the photo op stuff is good for a day's blip of publicity in news that people don't care about anyway. What matters is persistent grassroots pressure every day from the bottom up, and that's life in the trenches, and that's where you got to join me if you want to make that difference.
I'll stick up for using Twitter a little bit. I think there's an interesting a friend of mine, Henry Copeland, who started Blog Ads and actually created this tool called Twiangulate, T-W-I-angulate. And my husband does consulting in you know, social media campaigns and that kind of thing, and they were able to, doing an HIV/AIDS sort of one campaign thing, were able to target who was talking about what, who might be an influencer in that group, and then at reply to them, which I think is a really powerful and probably at this point underused tool. The at reply is, mm-hmm. I have a lot of people that I'm following on Twitter, but when someone replies to me, including while I'm sitting on a panel, I read that, and I often will react to people I would never have met before. There is a real sort of flattening of the game, of the ground there, leveling of the playing field, where you can contact people and be noticed in a way you wouldn't have before in a public forum, but it has this sort of personal feeling. And I think that's very important and probably a little underused at this point. I would also say that if you look at the studies on who uses Twitter and when and how, different communities use it very, very different ways. And particularly young, like teenage black users are very engaged on Twitter. And I think probably in the political sphere, not enough people have sort of tried to get in there and to become part of the conversation. They frequently lead all the trending topics, and I think are more engaged there than people know. And I don't think anybody has really figured out how to breach the gap there.
Yeah. Between Latina, the top users of Twitter are African American and then Latino. That's basically the scale. And part of, I mean, if you were to ask me as to why, it's one of the, they actually have one of the highest penetrations of smartphones. They've been using smartphones ever since. You remember the, I always would call the T-Mobile Sidekick the training wheels for being on the web, but that was back in 2004. So they've actually been, they have an ease of using this technology, and they find it as a way to communicate, much more so than heavy data Facebook would be.
And to Mary Catherine's point, I'll just say that Obama has taken those real people that are sending him replies and showcased them at the White House with this whole thing about, you know, what can $40 do for you? So your questions.
So, Christine, you explained a really a scenario of legacy where you start off the panel, you flip a light button, and all of a sudden you're funneled through by certain campaigns and certain causes. And you know, that's really a lot about what Eli Pryzer talks about with the filter bubble, and Facebook and Google basically showing you what you want to see.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm curious what all of you think about that phenomenon and what your organizations can do to counter it, or whether you're okay with it or you want to take advantage of it.
Well, I mean, it has its ups and downs. But yeah, I think it's concerning that a lot of people don't know that what they're getting is what they want to get, and they sort of, like, a lot of people don't know that your Google results look different from my Google results, or, you know, your Facebook ads look different. And so that's why I sort of ask people frequently about, like, who does your Facebook think you are? Look at your ads and sort of read this situation. And another, who Eli, you mentioned the filter bubble, and also my friend Clay Johnson wrote Information Diet, which are just, I think for us and for people who are involved in technology, who write about it, people listen to you and you influence them to be aware of what's going on and to write about it. And I think much like with voter registration, it's partly our duty to tell people this is what's going on. It certainly has its downsides. Obviously, the upside is that your experience is being tailored to what you're interested in. And I do think that the web gives you a way to work around it. As long as you know what's going on, information is abundant and available, and you can go find it, but you have to take that step. It's not necessarily being pushed to you. But I think you have the opportunity, like you never have before, of finding that other information.
Yeah, I think that's right, especially around politics. When you're going to make a decision about, you know, and you're at that last minute when you're walking, you know, preparing to go to the voting booth, I can just tell you by the number of phone calls we get, you know, like the day before Election Day last cycle, we had 20,000 people call our office with questions about, you know, where do I go and where can I find information? What's my ballot look like? And on and on and on. And we were actually pushing out a totally different 1-800 number for them to call. So when it comes to making that decision, it is something that people tend to take quite seriously. For us, we do think there's an ethical obligation to provide information that lets somebody make up their own mind, because then you become much more empowered by that decision and in that, and much more kind of invested in that decision. If you're deciding something like who's going to represent you, who's going to be making decisions about you and your community and your lives, we want you to actually think about that and be invested in that. And so having to make up your own mind and sort through information to make that decision is something that's a really powerful thing to do. We present all of that, though, through a youth lens. And we are hopefully pretty clear about the fact that we do that.
I think you're talking about what's often called confirmation bias or an echo chamber effect. It's very much real, and personally, I don't have a clue as to what to do about it because it's pretty deeply ingrained in all of us. So that's my emphasis then is starting to be preventing disinformation from being propagated badly, hence my interest in fact-checking, interest in factcheck.org, that kind of thing. If we can help restore trust in news by restoring fact-checking, at least we have a fighting chance of getting good information.
And I think the only thing I would add is that, unfortunately, acculturated Latinos are the ones that are most underserved when it comes to information. And I say that because you have basically, you have roughly 80% of all Latinos are English dominant, but most people immediately think that it's Spanish. So finding that information that is digestible, consumable, and then that they will go ahead and they want to share with their networks is actually an incredible opportunity for some. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have more have an armchair interest in politics, which is why I'm here, but from your experience, the people that are engaged online, do they tend, politically, do they tend to already kind of have their mindset, like, you know, this is who I am, and I'm more out there, less seeking information and more I'm trying to influence the conversation? And if that's the case, then sites like Fact Check, like, are those really reliable if the people that are already engaged online are kind of trying to skew perception?
From what I see, if someone's convinced already, then they're convinced. I think the fact-checking stuff is focused on the people who are genuine independents, who haven't made their mind up, and they're ready to listen.
And what you actually see among voter folks that register to vote, the majority of them are coming in as independents. So that speaks to me that there's a clear open mind, and that what they want is that they want the information, and they want the candidates to court them. And until that happens, I think that it's going to... And I think as the more vitriolic it becomes, the more people are going to basically step back and say, well, who's actually telling you the truth?
Mm-hmm. On this side of the room.
My name is Phil Presley. I'm an academic from the University of Maryland. And I work on language technology for analyzing social media sentiment analysis and so forth. This is sort of a follow-up of some previous two. There's a... concern not just about confirmation bias, but the sampling bias as well, especially across language. And a second issue has to do with the use of adversarial methods. Once you saw email emerge, you start and it mattered.
Yeah.
You started to see spam emerge. And I'm curious both about views of the sampling bias issue, and also whether you're already starting to see and be concerned about the use of the technology in deliberate ways in order to try to modify the distributions of what people are analyzing.
Yeah.
Well, I would say on the spam issue that there are, and it's partly to your question as well, there are a lot of people who do get engaged to be activists, and it's not necessarily that they are you know, trying to do anything wrong, but they do want to influence things. They've made up their mind about a certain issue, and they're out there to do that. And then this partly plays into yours, is that in social media, there is such a premium on being genuine. That is what makes your audience. That's what makes people respond to you or listen to you or do anything that you suggest doing. And that is the part, that's sort of the saving grace, because people are always going to arm up on both sides, politically speaking, to just, you know, clamor, you know, take down whoever. And with Fact Check, for instance, there are two sides of people fact-checking factcheck.org. So it's so that's just the way it works. But there is such a premium on that realness. I think that's the saving grace in social media, and it's more that way in social media than it is in traditional media. And because that's what works, I think you get a lot of real people doing real things and communicating in a genuine way. And that's why some of the adversarial techniques and the more staid campaign techniques will become less and less effective, and we'll have new ways of conquering them because it really does put the power with us and with people who are willing to be themselves and to be real. So,
yeah, I can just give you some case studies because we track all of that work and have for many years. But on email, for example, you know, we have a relationship with our users and they've registered to vote with us, which is where the majority of our email list comes from. They rely on us then for information about elections. When we send that, they read it. So then we thought, oh, this is great. What if we actually want to reach out and register 18 to 24-year-old, you know, African-American men in this state? Can we buy an email list with that and have the same success that way? And as it turns out, that's called spam. They don't open it. They didn't read it. And we probably depressed, you know, registration and turnout in that area as a result. That's probably not true, but it had no impact. So what we learned was, yes, spam is in email is, you know, kind of turned the corner on that. However, the relationship mattered. And so, you know, it's not just about the method, but it's also about the relationship with the audience and with the users. And we've kind of taken that as we look at, you know, text messaging. So right now, a text message on election day is having the same turnout impact as a live phone call for our audience. That's how personal it feels. So we have to respect that, otherwise we're going to lose that. But then second, the idea of relationship we're trying to translate into all of these other methods. So, you know, instead of thinking about neighborhood the way we used to, you know, we're organizing campaigns by neighborhood where you're knocking on doors and you're talking to your neighbor. Maybe for my grandparents that still works because they know their neighbors and their kids all grew up together and whatnot. But for the audience that I'm trying to reach and organize, it's more about their network. And so having them be the ones conveying this information rather than us within their own networks using whatever methods they're comfortable using right now is what's keeping it authentic and continuing that. And it's based on that relationship once again.
I've been a customer service rep as of this month for 17 years. I've seen everything that your question suggests. Dirty tricks played not only by professionals but by amateurs, since everyone can pick up a book talking about their dirty tricks. The good news is that people are getting to recognize when that kind of thing is happening, and they'll call shenanigans as needed.
So we have time for one more question. I think you had your hand up.
You kind of touched on it a little bit off and on, but one shift that I've seen from 2008 to today is that because Twitter and Facebook have gone mainstream, you get a lot. I mean, politicians can't control their brand anymore. They can't control the information or misinformation going out there through mainstream media and traditional ways because I'm hearing it from my friends, you know, your friends. This year, I've really noticed people are not holding back on their views. Mm. And so they're sharing blogs, they're sharing all kinds of things, and I'm really wondering how that is going to impact this upcoming.
Well, and it's also the most effective kind of communication when you talk about turning it into political action. That is the point that matters. Is friend to friend, neighbor to neighbor, whatever the neighborhood is, that's what gets you going. And that's what Facebook and Twitter have just accelerated that normal sharing and made it so easy to turn that into an action, signing a petition, whatever it is, calling Congress, that it's hugely important. And I think I'm sort of laissez-faire about this. I think, you know, more people talking, the better. And yes, there are people who are lying, but there are other people fact-checking them. And I say, oh, have it all. It's great. So I'm not super wary about it. I know other people are. But to me, that they can't control their brand as well as they used to is a great thing. And yes, there's going to be misinformation, but there's also other people trying to get it right. And it's challenging for us, and I think as influencers, like I keep saying, it is our job to tell people that there is a new way that you can consume this media, and there are smart ways to do it, and there are not so smart ways, and communicating about that is part of our job in these media.
And I kind of like it. I'm in your camp. Like, go at it. Because as an organization that's trying to empower people and create a space where they step up and take self-responsibility to kind of take ownership over this country and this democracy, the more they make the brand their own, the more they invest in it, the stronger we are as an organization, and I think that's a positive thing. So I've been kind of encouraged by it, and it tends to play itself out, but has always been our approach.
Yeah, the only thing you can do about it is to seriously engage your community and then stay seriously engaged with your community, and you just got to commit to doing that. Think of it as forever. I'm committed to doing customer service only as long as I live. And that's going to have to be the attitude of everyone in this kind of business. All I can say is a nerd's got to do what a nerd's got to do.
And I think we'll leave it there. So thank you so much to the terrific panel. One note. You are all invited. PBS is having an awesome Sherlock Holmes party. This will be at the Parish Bar at 9 o'clock till 1 in the morning. And there's a Facebook event page that you can find. It's http://pbs-sbysxsw. Anyway, thank you very much to everybody. Have a great time. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be great.